Welcome to the Center for Lit Podcast Network. You're listening to How to Eat an Elephant, a little book club for large books. Have you ever cast your eyes across a shelf full of classics and been driven screaming from the room by 500-page monsters with thick spines and important names? Then this is the show for you. We're here to take on these scary books together, because how do you eat an elephant? One bite at a time. Well, hello, my friends. Welcome back to How to Eat an Elephant, back after a long absence. Unless you're one of those people who joined the show like last week and has been furiously binging every moment of the day between now or then and now.
Yeah. Anyways. Do you think they could do that? I think there are too many even for that.
I'm doing
show.
That with a TV show right this second.
Okay, it's possible. Go there.
So we are entering the last leg of what has been, I was going to say brutal, but it's not brutal. It's been a joy.
It's been a joy,
but it's been very, very long. A very long joy. A prolonged joy. We are entering volume 4, the final volume of Tolstoy's War and Peace, to which there will be 4 parts. And it's as though Tolstoy just cannot give up the last word, because the final volume, which consists of 4 parts, is followed by an epilogue, which consists of 2. So in reality, we're like the length of a standard size novel from being done with this book.
Tolstoy is looking at us like, can't stop, won't stop.
I'm sorry, can't do it. We're on page 936 and it ends on 1215. So some 300 pages left to go, but it does feel like we're winding down, does it not?
It does.
Yeah, or at least getting to the climax.
It is interesting how we've circled back to the beginning, though.
Yeah.
The beginning of this section feels like the beginning of every other section.
I know. I was going to say, it feels like the beginning of the whole book, but also the beginning of every single volume. It's like he circles back to the drawing room to start a new thought.
I wonder why that is. I mean, it's true. Our first chapter is definitely in the drawing room.
Yeah.
And it's also rewinding like a few weeks, right, from where we ended our previous section.
Yep.
So that we get a picture of Petersburg Society's look at the happenings in Moscow and Kutuzov's retreat and all of that. But I think this whole part is pretty funny. I think there's lots of funny. Anytime Anna Pavlovna shows up on the scene and starts fluttering about trying to be a leader of thought in the Russian community, it ends up being pretty funny. So what do you guys notice here in this first chapter? I mean, are there camps? Are there various entrenched positions, politically speaking? Have those changed from earlier sections of the novel?
Well, one thing I had to actually go and look up, because again, you guys, I'm not here for my historical knowledge. There are 2 different empresses at this time. One of them is the mother of the sovereign and the other is the wife of the sovereign.
So the queen mother and...
Yeah. Yeah, like the dowager empress and then the I don't know. Consort of the sovereign, you know, whatever it is.
There's a whole lingo.
I don't know what it is. Anyways, they have 2 different camps, ways that they are representing being a true Russian. And I think they are indicative of the mood of the time. Everybody is getting their identity from how they are responding to the larger conflict. But what I noticed about this section is the lack of meaning behind their positions. They really don't have a lot of information. And so they're just posturing and posing and making identities for themselves. But the line, they did not understand the meaning of these events, comes up again and again in this chapter.
It's true. Yeah, he repeats that.
Yeah.
I also love, and it's a tie-in to a later chapter that we'll discuss later. I'm not going to bring it all up now. But when the sovereign is pictured for a minute or two in this section, his position is likewise disconnected from any reality.
Yeah.
In fact, I think Tolstoy might even argue that there's nothing that someone this far above the fray can do.
Mm-hmm. That seems to parallel or mirror the personal situation going on here, too. That this is, we get some of the most gritty, like scurrilous details that about a personal life that we've gotten thus far. Thank you for pulling out my dictionary.
There's the thesaurus on the table today.
But... It's getting real. Like there's a real situation taking place here. And yet it's very, the way that we hear about it and the way that it's discussed in the drawing room is just like the political situation, very detached. It's very not real.
Well, yeah, it's, again, it's more about the people who are talking about it than the subject of their conversation. It's not really about this woman who's having some issues. It's about the way that they are being perceived in how they're talking about her, mm-hmm. which I think is, I think you're right, Emily. It's on the personal front and also the political front. It's the same impulse.
Well, and Tolstoy's been doing this all along. He's been using the relationship of an individual to the society and to the nation to mirror the relationship of an individual to the family and the personal community, and talking and using them just to reflect each other back and forth over and over right. again. Though in this scene, I think it's important that we start with Prince Vasily, who's going to be asked by Anna Pavlovna, the supreme poser queen of all the posers,
yeah.
to read a missive of some kind because of his stentorian baritone and his style, right? Which Tolstoy is careful to tell us is like this. I'm just going to read it. This is a great line. Artistic recitation consisted in pouring out words loudly, melodiously, alternating between a desperate howl and a tender murmur, quite regardless of their meaning, so that it was quite by chance that one word fell in with the howling and others with the murmuring. So here we have a guy who's, just like you said, Megan, his opinions and the things that he's uttering reflect only on himself. They are merely tools in his toilet, just like his mustache wax.
Yes, exactly.
It's really all that it is. Doesn't bear any relationship to anything. And using him as a lens to look through all of this, I think we're going to see a bunch of expressions of that happening for five chapters. Yep,
putting emphasis in the wrong places.
Right.
Yeah, it's such a great image.
Man, after a long list of great images, he still is coming up with them. It's kind of amazing.
Well, I like what you said, Ian, that we get a bunch of different versions of that image. We have Bilibin, who is going to prepare another bone mow, and he gathers his skin, which I think is a yeah. weird way of saying
what did that mean? I thought about it for way longer than I wanted to.
I thought so too. It was such a strange way of phrasing that. But he's gathering his skin to make a bone mow that's really going to have some punch and significance, and it's totally forgettable and doesn't mean anything. And you have Prince Ippolit. I don't know how to say yeah. that correctly, but
who
Prince
immediately Ippolit. Stands. Has he yeah. been Bilibin's foil all along?
I think so. Yeah, I think so. He is generally acknowledged, for those who don't remember, as an idiot in society. He's always making a fool of himself. So Bilibin is held up as he is the essence of wit, right? He's the smartest of us and diplomatic in all of his word choices. And Ippolit is quite the opposite. And in this moment, goes ahead and tries to make a bone mow of his own. And is kind of haphazard about it, doesn't mean anything at all, and he knows it, and he kind of hopes it'll blow over. But the two of them are doing exactly the same thing in this scene in their own way, and neither one of their assessments of what's going on, even their jokes, they just don't land at all.
Man, it's really true. There are so many moments of just stirring irony throughout these five chapters, and lots of them are laughable, some of them are painful. In the thing that I want to notice here in this first chapter is the fact that Helene comes up, and all of a sudden we're getting an account of that relationship from the flip side, not from Pierre's perspective, but from the perspective of a bunch of people who are, shockingly, on Helene's side. What did you guys make of all of that?
Well, that's kind of what I meant by the fact that they, just as in the political situation, they're putting the emphasis in the wrong place, that we get that amazingly understated sentence. Let's see.
On page 936.
Everyone knew very well that the lovely countess's illness came from the inconvenience of marrying two husbands at once, and that the Italian's treatment consisted in removing that inconvenience. So.
But finish the sentence.
But in Anna Pavlovna's presence, not only did no one dare to think about it, but it was as if no one knew it.
Yes. Ignoring something that is common knowledge and right before one's face because it's convenient to do so.
Well, and one of the ways that they're ignoring it is by calling it something other than what it is. They call it an inconvenience. They call it a sickness. The sickness has a weird name.
Yeah, angina pectoris.
Yeah.
Basically, it's a heart condition, which is, you know, metaphorically appropriate.
Right. Yeah, she does have a sick heart. But I think we're led to believe, and correct me if I'm wrong here, but reading between the lines, Helene is pregnant yep. because she's been unfaithful to her husband, really obviously so in society. And society is winking at it. And she's trying to get rid of that inconvenience, quote unquote.
Yep.
So pretty shocking immorality to be winked at here in society.
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. And it's literally just because she's beautiful, right?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, she's empty-headed.
And maybe because of her relationship to Prince Vasily.
Well, and she holds a high social position.
Yeah. So the count, by the way, in case any of the readers missed, which I did for half a section before realizing it in a flash, the old count that's described is her new intended.
Consort, yeah.
Yeah, her new consort. Pierre is the young count. Pierre is Bezhukhov, her husband. So that was confusing to me.
Well, they just want to be on the right side of history, right? If it does end up that she leaves Pierre and ends up married to the count and they have a child together, well, you don't want to be on record, just like Vasily and his whole going back and forth about his opinion about Kutuzov. The rest of society doesn't want to be on record as having the wrong opinion about Helene's relationship.
Yeah.
Well, I also thought, you don't know how many more she's going to have, you know, how many more consorts. You don't know where she's going to land. The last time we saw her, correct me if I'm wrong, she had two different ones she was trying to decide between. Two different ones beyond Pierre that she was trying to you know, balance and keep happy with one another. And she's a playa.
Yeah, she's a total playa. Well, and I think Emily's right to point to Prince Vasily. I would call him kind of a fulcrum for the section, for the shift between here's how it goes in society. Now let's turn to individual characters and talk about their situations. Vasily stands in the middle of that with his posturing and posing and his speech that means nothing and all of that. And everybody's responses to Vasily indicate the position of their hearts and the seriousness of their minds.
The fact that he is able to moderate his opinion of Kutuzov to be the correct one for the social moment in the same moment where he's being visited by those who wish to console him on the death of Helene, his own daughter, is really shocking.
Yeah.
That he's even in that most devastating moment, the loss of a beloved child, that he is still being socially conscious in that moment. It's horrible.
It is. It's terrifying.
Yeah, everything about the articulation of Helene's death is really horrifying. I'm actually going to read it because of the phrasing. That day, Prince Vasily no longer boasted of his protege Kutuzov, but kept silent when the conversation turned to the commander-in-chief, because public opinion has turned away from Kutuzov, right? Besides, towards the evening of that day, it was as if everything combined to plunge the inhabitants of Petersburg into anxiety and worry. One more piece of terrible news was added. Countess Elena Bezukhov had died suddenly of that terrible illness, the name of which it had been so pleasant to articulate. So what they're emphasizing even there is how fun it was to say angina pectoralis or whatever it was, rather than the death of the most charming woman in St. Petersburg, as they had said. Oh my goodness, it's just chilling.
They've just lost all contact with people and with reality.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, and it's implied that it's funny. He's actually compassionate to her. Tolstoy, I mean, in this moment as well. I mean, it's a suicide, right? That in some ways is driven by the fact that nobody cares and everyone's a pawn. And
is it a suicide or is it a desire for hurry? Because
I think it's implied that, so the story went that Prince Vasily and the old count were about to set upon the Italian, her doctor. But the Italian showed them such notes from the unfortunate deceased that they let him go.
Hmm.
So she, I mean, suicide note and all, killed herself.
I see.
I think I missed it because, spoiler alert, the BBC version that we keep referencing has a very specific reading of this scene. And they demonstrate it as she's furiously writing to Pierre, which is also implied in this moment. I think it could be taken either way, that she's begging him to release her from their marriage and hurrying things. So maybe there's an element of both.
Well, in any case, it serves to highlight the moment when the destiny of Russia is in the balance, because the entirety of the city of Petersburg, high and low, has taken an initial report from Rostopchin, who is the... Actually, no, wait, hang on. That's the second report.
Yeah, yeah.
Who's the first report from?
You mean of the abandoning of Moscow?
No, uh-uh. The abandoning of Moscow is the one that turns opinion. Opinion is set in motion in the first place by a positive report. Mm-hmm. And so the entire city begins to, right, to embellish. Mm-hmm. They assume that the victory is won. They start talking about Napoleon being captured and a new leader for France being selected. And like they really swing one direction. And then we get an account from Rostopchin. And we already know about Rostopchin. We've already listened to that whole situation. And so we can see in the account that he is lying to preserve his own reputation. I've evacuated everything. I did everything as quickly as I possibly could. You did not. You drug your feet the entire time. Mm-hmm. You're completely useless. When Kutuzov needed you, you right. did absolutely nothing. But here he is delivering grievous news as the only responsible person here because Kutuzov has abandoned his post, right? I mean, it stinks to high heaven.
Mm-hmm. Well, and even the very fact that he sends a report, Kutuzov is silent on this right. issue. And I don't think it's necessarily because he wants to keep the news himself, but rather he's just, you know, present in the moment and making decisions for the field. Whereas Rostopchin apparently has time in the midst of this crisis to put a spin on events right. and make sure that Petersburg society right. is notified.
Everybody knows how he is and how important he is. So, okay, this leads us to sort of our central chapter, which is the third one of our new part here. And I want to know what you guys think about this. This is a wild section from my perspective. We get an interview with the sovereign and Kutuzov's messenger. Now, Kutuzov's messenger is not a Russian. He's a Frenchman. But he himself has declared loyalty to the Russian sovereign. So he is, if you will, a boiled down and concentrated version of every court nincompoop that we've seen in the novel thus far. Every Russian who doesn't have the soul of Russia and who speaks French instead is summed up in this messenger from Kutuzov, the actual face of Russia who's actually in the field doing his work, and the sovereign who is more interested in drawing room culture than battle. So what are the contents of the interview? I mean, I thought this was just the peak of irony, but I want to hear what you guys noticed.
Well, I noticed, first of all, that the Frenchman is very concerned that the emperor see him as a true Russian in his heart. And he is trying to frame the news that he's responsible to bring in a way that will impress the sovereign and encourage him to keep being sovereign over all of Russia. And to keep his chin up, right? He wants to, A, make himself look good, like a true Russian, even though he's French, and we get that over and over again through this whole chapter. And then, B, encourage the sovereign as if he is a breakable, delicate, emotional kid.
Yeah. Which, frankly, he kind of is. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Except for he's not so delicate because he takes the time to set up a joke, right? To make himself yes. look better. He makes it sound as though everything is lost.
The emperor is delicate.
The emperor is delicate.
That's what I mean. Frenchman. Right, but the Frenchman risks hurting the emperor to set up a joke in which he says everything is lost, the army fears, and the emperor starts to raise his hackles, and the guy says, everyone fears that you're not going to let them kick the butts of the bad guys.
Yeah.
It's literally like a speech that precedes a battle in an action movie, in a modern action movie. Here's all the dirt we're going to do to the enemy.
Yeah.
But yeah, no, that's a good way to put it because it's acted, right? It's an artificial act that he's putting on to make something of the moment. And as we know, every time someone tries to make something of the moment, it doesn't go well.
Well, and so then let's look at the sovereign's promises, because first of all, I want to note, he says this to an empty room plus a Frenchman. So nothing, I mean, you can hear Tolstoy maybe even venomously sitting in his chair, scratching out this chapter. Like the sovereign in his sovereignness mm-hmm. is sitting in an office right by himself with a Frenchman for Pete's sake and is still performing. Is mm-hmm. still in a pageant and is basically taking every single word as an opportunity to burnish his own image. And what he said, he promises two things. Number one, he says, go tell my army that if it becomes necessary, I will lead the nobility and the peasants into the field. Mm. Right? So I'm going to come and imagine being Kutuzov receiving this news. Oh, that'll be great. When the massive, unbelievable resources of your entire nation and all of your best soldiers, including me, the person who actually has more power than you as the leading general of the world. I mean, we're looking at Napoleon across the way, who was just a general until he was an emperor because generals have all of the real power, right? So you're gonna tell Kutuzov that when you failed, I'll take a crack at it. That's gonna encourage the real soldiers to no end, Your Majesty. Then his next promise is, and then when that fails, I'm going to grow my beard out to the middle of my chest. assume a friar's robes, and go eat potatoes with the peasants. Mm-hmm. How are either of those things remotely helpful?
Well, I don't think they are. They're both pretty obviously self-aggrandizing images that he clings to in his worst moments, right? Here's the way that I will seem to my people. I would have you see me this way, as an emperor who is willing to appreciate your sacrifices. It's a lot of hot air. But I do think the promise, it's localized around being a man of the people. And I was just reminded of the last time he was on the battlefield and Kutuzov couldn't wait for him to leave. He wanted him to leave so that he could continue being a symbol for the people. Mm-hmm. That actually his most helpful action could be to stay removed and to represent the Russian pride. Hmm. And so I'm not sure that this is entirely a negative thing. Hmm. I do see a lot of what you're talking about, that it's self-aggrandizing and icky. But at the same time, I think that this is the one function that the emperor has, is to maybe be their idea of a monarch who would do this for them.
I can see what you mean. I don't necessarily have a problem with that. On the other hand, I don't know if Tolstoy approves of that one thing that monarchy can do.
I agree with you.
Right? Yeah. I mean, that he's right in saying this is all a monarch is for. Mm-hmm. And then he brings a Frenchman in to listen to the speech. Right? Like, I mean, there's such a heavy layer of sarcasm over the top of this whole chapter that it's hard for me to ignore it. But I think you're right. Maybe the sovereign, to be kind to him for a minute, has actually rightly understood his role.
Maybe. Or maybe this is by accident. He actually is fulfilling all that he can really do. And he's also to be laughed at in the process. I think Tolstoy is many layered, and it's probably
it
all
seems
of it.
Like he's laughing at kind of all of us. I mean, I don't know what you think about this, Emily, but this seems to be the pinnacle. I mean, he has slowly worked his way up from dudes on the battlefield into families leaving Russia, and then into high society in Petersburg, and then into the sovereign's office. And then the very next chapter, in chapter 4, he goes ahead and talks history and emphasizes his point again in maybe the clearest way he has thus far. And he opens it by saying, there are personal interests and there are the interests of the time. And everyone's concerned with the former and not the latter, no matter how much they protest to the contrary.
Yeah, it strikes me that we are the more disenchanted with the emperor, the closer that we are to him. And it's the fact of his being an individual that makes the statement about going to eat potatoes so repulsive. Huh. Whereas the further that statement is carried away from him and is delivered to the people, it actually does work. It's when it becomes disembodied, a disembodied statement from the emperor, I can see that that would actually be an encouragement to the troops. It probably would inspire them with patriotism. Mm-hmm. But it's that we are uncomfortable with it because we are privy to the situation at hand. We know who he's talking to. We can sense the motivations for him saying this, and it's repulsive.
Right. The disingenuousness we can sense, you know?
Right.
It also strikes me that he's actually not dissimilar from our beloved Pierre, who has tried both of these things. Putting himself at the head of a military regiment, and he has tried being the simple,
to be one of them, quote unquote.
Yeah, the simple man, the simple beggar, the simple man who just wants to be one of the people. So
I love this next bit, and I think it just flows so perfectly. So unless you guys are chomping to say something about this,
I do have one
chapter
more.
3. Go ahead.
Yeah, think about your transition for just a second, because I just had to point out that Tolstoy constantly surprises me, and even in translation, his vocabulary is so gigantic. And there is a word at the end of this last chapter that we were talking about that I can't pass up. Have you guys ever heard of plenipotentiary before? That is a sweet word. Do you know what it means? Here's the sentence. He says, he being the French guy, Michaud or whatever his name is, he expressed in the following terms his own feelings, as well as the feelings of the Russian people, of whom he regarded himself as the plenipotentiary. And I thought, what is a plenipotentiary? So I looked it up. And for your information, readers, here's what it means. A diplomat invested with full power of independent action on behalf of their government, typically in a foreign country. And if you think about the definition of that word, that's ironic in and of itself. He is a foreigner in Russia who thinks that he's representing the interests of the Russian people in a foreign country. It's emphasizing his foreignness, even as he thinks he stands for them. That is an amazing word. Adding it to my vocabulary.
Epic. But also, it's what a great little instance of the skill of the translator. The translator could have chose something like representative or diplomatic representative, and that probably would have conveyed the literal sense. But even in choosing the word plenipotentiary, we get a sense in English of the way in which this man has aggrandized himself, right? The sophistication with which he views his position.
You can't forget that we're reading an interpretation, right? Every translation is one of those. It's awesome.
Anyway, I had to get that final shot in there.
No, I think it's great. Well, it actually ties in really well to the next section, as did Emily's previous comment as well, because he's going to jump from this picture of individual persons acting away and start saying, it's still ironic every time he does it, but he's going to start saying, don't try and draw conclusions about humanity. Just talk about people, individuals doing their thing. That's what life is really made of, right? And we're a whole swarm. We're a big swarm of people, and that swarm is comprised of everyone's individual decisions, and you can't sort them out and you can't unify them, and basically just sit and enjoy it and everything will be fine. But in doing that, he's doing the very we've talked about it before. Mm-hmm. Anyways, in this instance, it's maybe the clearest expression of his historical hermeneutic that we get.
Yeah.
And he draws the first distinction between the general historical interest of the time and the personal interests of the time. And he more or less says that everyone is concerned with the personal interests rather than the general ones. And given that everyone is concerned with the personal interests and not the general ones, there's two kinds of folks. Those who are honest in considering personal interests above general ones, and those who pretend to consider general ones over personal ones. And one of those is useful and one of them isn't. And so I want to read this paragraph to you because I find this actually to be somewhat applicable to our own era. And maybe it's been applicable to all eras, as is the habit of great literature. But I actually see this and see people from our own time in this. Those, however, who tried to understand the general course of things and wanted to take part in it with self-sacrifice and heroism were the most useless members of society. They saw everything inside out, and everything they did to be useful turned out to be useless. Nonsense. Like Pierre's Mamonov's regiments, which looted Russian villages, like the lint that young ladies plucked and that never got to the wounded, and so on. Even those who were fond of being clever and expressing their feelings when discussing the present situation of Russia involuntarily gave their speeches the stamp either of pretense and falseness or of useless condemnation and spite against the people, accusing them of something no one could be guilty of. In historical events, what is most obvious is the prohibition against eating the fruit of the tree of knowledge. Only unconscious activity bears fruit, and a man who plays a role in a historical event never understands its significance. If he attempts to understand it, he is struck with fruitlessness.
So good. I agree. I think this is one of the most powerful articulations of his point that Tolstoy has made thus far.
Yeah, I agree with you. Put it in your own words. I mean, how would you put it in our modern parlance?
Well, it makes sense of the ancient wisdom to know that you don't know, right? Mm-hmm. Socrates was the man who didn't know anything.
Right.
Because once we, and it starts in the garden, right? It starts with man. It's the tree of knowledge that was the forbidden fruit. And that's so antithetical to the way that human beings are set up, right? We think that to know is the best good. And so we set out to critically analyze and understand everything and be the ones who know. But actually, like, that's the fall, is knowing. And it's best when we don't have to know, because we surrender our right to understand to God, who is ultimate understanding. And we which we do not have access to.
Right.
And every time man tries to set himself up as the all-knowing, that's when he makes a mess of things.
Mm. Yeah, it's really true. What do you think, Megan?
I think that. I'm still thinking on it. Yeah, I think I couldn't say it better.
Yeah, I know. I agree. Neither could I. That was super well done. I think the to sum up, humility, right? Tolstoy advocates humility before history, humility before the other, humility before God, and a right sense of self. You are little. He keeps saying it. You're little. You're little. The biggest and most powerful impact your life can have is on the person standing right in front of you.
Well, and I like the emphasis on unconsciousness too. Like, you, the most useful things that you do are quite by accident, as if someone else is using you in a great story. Right. The things that you do on purpose are usually tainted by your own self-image and their identity projects. I think that's one of the things that Tolstoy is demonstrating in the drawing room scenes. And here he's making a philosophical point so that you don't miss it, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree with you. I think that's exactly what he's doing. And doesn't it just make you think of the political pundits of our era? I mean, for one second, take the Rona, for example, right? No matter which side of the political spectrum you're standing on, you know about this issue. You've encountered it. It's affected your life. And regardless of your issues on the science of the problem, I think we can pretty much all unite in our distaste for the politicians that are using it for political gain instead of addressing it as a real issue. And that seems to be all of them, pretty much all of them, right? Punditry is something that Tolstoy despises. He absolutely despises it. And I think what he's doing here is using the language that he would use to talk about a political pundit to talk about normal humans. In your average life, you are doing this. Pay attention, right? Look at yourself in the mirror. Understand that you just are taking yourself too seriously. Take a chill pill. That's basically what Tolstoy is saying. Chill. Oh, dude, you should just chill.
Chill.
And I need it, man.
Yeah, the way that you can chill is by recognizing that there are forces greater than yourself who might be in the right seat by ordaining the issues of your life. I mean, we immediately transition in this chapter to the personal again. We go to Nikolai Rostov, who Tolstoy holds up as a great example of being useful because you are unselfconscious. Right? He says, if Nikolai had been asked what he thought of the present situation in Russia, he would have said that there was nothing for him to think, that Kutuzov and others were there for that, and that he had heard that regiments were being replenished, and it must mean the fighting would go on for a long time yet. In other words, that's above my pay grade. I trust other minds to be considering the general interests, and I will content myself with the personal interests. I wonder if this is Tolstoy recommending that we think like Nikolai. What do you think about that?
I actually was having the same thought. I kind of agree with you about that. He doesn't let anybody get off scot-free, no. Right? Even our heroes have villainous moments, but I do think he recommends Nikolai's perspective here, because here he is just tootling along through life and kind of enjoying it when he can. And he's decorated with the highest honor of Russia. He's a legendary soldier. We know that isn't true of him. And Tolstoy seems to be saying, that's all right. He's fine. He'll be fine. Mm-hmm. Then meanwhile, him and his romantic dalliances are about to get himself in some trouble, I think.
Right, yeah.
I sniff trouble down the road. Paint the picture for me, Emily. How do we find Nikolai here in this last chapter?
Well, he is feeling pretty fine. he is sowing his wild oats here. He's awarded. He's handsome, and he is out for a night on the town. He's just been released to go gather more troops, and so he gets to leave camp life, which, by the way, if we remember, he specifically put himself inside of camp life because he wanted to avoid his issues. But now he's been there too long, and he's ready to rock and roll. And he
there's a particular reason for him wanting to get out. It's because the women inside the camp all have 10, 12 different men following around after them, and they look, frankly, rode hard and put away wet. And the women in the countryside look plump and happy and welcome his attentions because they don't have 10 or 12 men following them around. I don't mean to put too fine a point on it, but that is what's in here.
Yeah, it says he'd stepped into a position of the universal favorite, which befitted him in the province and was always agreeable. but now, after prolonged privation, made him drunk with pleasure.
Made him drunk with pleasure.
Yeah, he wants some attention.
Yeah. And he gets it.
He sure does, man. I think one of the funniest lines in this scene is Nikolai flirting with a married woman and Tolstoy's phrasing of that truth. That is what's happening. Keep that in the forefront of your mind. Here's how Tolstoy describes it. All evening, Nikolai paid most attention to a blue-eyed, plump, and sweet-looking blonde, the wife of one of the provincial officials. With the naive conviction of young men making merry, that other men's wives were created for them, Rostov never left this lady's side and treated her husband in a friendly, somewhat conspiratorial way, as if, though there was no talk of it, they knew how nicely they would get along together. That is, Nikolai and this husband's wife. Oh, man.
You don't have to commit in that situation because Nikolai is not going to do the Helene thing, right? I think we know his character well enough to know that he's not actually going to try to convince a married woman to marry him instead. What this is a situation in which he has no responsibility. He actually can't pursue this woman.
There are no consequences.
She's off limits. Yeah, there are no consequences. And so he can delight in being admired without having to do anything about it.
Yeah, he can, and I quote, pay her mythological compliments. Which is a great line. I just love it.
Oh, man.
So it turns out he encounters a relative of one of our friends.
Yeah, he does.
Now, this is a distant aunt, as it were.
The Bokonski mother's sister, who's gone. We have never met Mrs. Bolkonsky.
Princess Maria's aunt on her mother's side. A wealthy childless widow who lived year-round in Voronezh.
Yeah, and we learned that she did not like old Bolkonsky at all, which might be why we haven't heard of her before, given that Maria was basically joined at the hip with her father. This aunt did not like her father and so kept her distance, perhaps.
So there's a marked change in Nikolai when he's summoned to meet this woman. The reason, of course, that he's summoned is because he's met Maria. Maria has noised it about, and now he's being invited to interview, more or less, with an aunt of the family. And there's a really marked change in his demeanor. How would you guys describe it?
My immediate reading of him was he was ashamed of himself. The moment that he thought of Princess Maria, the way that he was behaving in this scene, thinking about women as playthings and no commitment as no consequences. He was ashamed of all of those things immediately and begins to reflect on himself. He's led in the next scene to tell all of his secrets and be really open and honest with the first woman who asks him, what kind of a man is he? Is he tied down? He begins to think of his responsibilities as a result of Princess Maria coming into his mind.
Interesting. So then it's actually a double, it's like, have you guys seen the movie Inception?
Yeah.
You know how the whole point of it is to go like down in dreams, to fall asleep and dream a next level down, and pretty soon you're just penetrating your subconscious all the time. That's what's happening to Nikolai here, because the mention of Princess Maria, to whom he is not promised, causes him to take a step back from his frivolous activities. And that's going to happen to him again when the notion of a serious relationship with Princess Maria is broached, and it takes him back to Sophie, whom he has made promises to. Actual promises, right? Like, as far as the two of them are concerned, they're engaged to be married.
It's probably significant for this section and maybe for the whole volume that Helene's death sits over and above everything that's going on. Like, if this is the last volume, I don't know what Tolstoy is going to do in the epilogue, but
the epilogue's more or less another volume anyway.
Assumably, some things are going to start, you know, coming to their close in this section. And so we're going to start seeing some consequences. And Helene's is the ultimate example that sits as a warning above everything that's happening. Nikolai kind of stands under the shadow of Helene's example. Helene wanted no consequences, whatever, for anything. And here he is kind of in danger.
He's flirting with
it. He's flirting with it. Yeah. I don't think that he would actually do that, like I said already, but like it does kind of stand in shadow over this life that he, this monumental decision he has to make. Huh.
Well, I mean, does anyone care to guess what he's going to do? I mean, I will say with some respect for the young man, he does eventually get around to saying, here's the problem. I have this cousin, Sophie. I love her. And I've promised to marry her, so nothing can happen between me and Princess Maria. And so he's set up as sort of a bastion against the room for maybe how long, Megan? Two sentences? Three?
Two sentences. Yeah. Because the woman that he's talking to says, recognizing like his mother does, his financial circumstance is probably going to guide his action in the end. She says, you and Sophie have got to understand, you can't get married because of all of these other things. And Tolstoy says Nikolai was silent. It was pleasant for him to hear these conclusions. So there's the Nikolai that we know and love right there.
Right.
He stood firm for about 2 seconds in when you have promised, you must follow through. And actually, he's entertaining in his mind not following through at all.
Right. And he's gonna pay lip service to it, though. All the same, it cannot be. But let's get back to the conversation. Could Princess Maria even do it? I mean,
right. Yeah. Let's entertain that, shall we? Mm-hmm.
So my heart is broken for Sophie already. That's what you're telling me? Come on.
Well, I kind of want to dig into that. Like, does he actually owe anything to Sophie? Is there something vulgar in the governor's wife's admonition that they not marry because what really matters is the financial situation? Or is there some actual earthy wisdom to this?
Because it is considering his family. There is actually something really true. There's responsibility there. His whole family is waiting on him to stop messing around and consider their interests. It's a family full of women and old men and a young boy. He's responsible and he's avoiding it, as we know. So I think you're right to point that out, that there is real wisdom in what this woman says, whether she is actually thinking about him or not.
Yeah, I kind of agree with you. I don't think it can be disagreed with that she's saying something wise. But the heart, though, I want Sophie to be okay.
Well, I also wonder about that, though, because what the woman says, if she is a truth teller, and she's faceless, she has no other purpose in this scene other than to tell the truth, I don't think. She says, Sophie, if she's a girl with a heart, what sort of life will it be for her? Which made me wonder, what kind of a heart does Sophie have to require this of Nikolai? I think that's one of the dark horse relationships in the story. What is her motivation? Can we trust it? Is she really loving Nikolai by requiring this promise of him when she knows just as well as we do that this would not be good for him or for the family that she's indebted to?
And she's not requiring it, though, right? She keeps insisting that he's free, but I don't know. There's something kind of manipulative. There's something about that.
Yeah, and she's also displayed some manipulative tendencies in a couple of different scenes.
But this is a childhood relationship, and the fact that they're hanging on to it in the face of adult circumstances seems more and more inappropriate as time goes on. And at some point, Sophie should probably be moving and shaking and finding other prospects.
She does have options. I mean, she goes into society with Natasha multiple times in the story. And I think she could be looking, you know?
Yeah. Well, and yeah, I think you're right. I guess what this made me think of was comparing it to another relationship, the one between Natasha and Andre. And I think that comparison is implied when Nikolai says, well, I couldn't consider it while my sister and her brother were involved, right? And Tulsa just goes, let's compare these. Let's think about it together, right? To what extent is the Natasha and Andre relationship also childish and also something that is passing because it had to do with children becoming adults? That's interesting to me. Yeah, I don't think we have enough information to really have the conversation right this minute, but
I hadn't thought about that.
I thought about that for a second. Mm-hmm. Well, guys, that was super fun as usual. Glad to be back in the saddle for our latest part. 5 more chapters for the next go around. And I'll be interested to see how he wraps this up. It seems like he continues to spool out thread, and I'm really wondering when he's going to weave it. It's time for weaving. It's time to weave. So anyway, bated breath, as per the usual. Thank you guys both for your brilliant comments.
I guess my parting shot this time is there going to be one climactic moment in War and Peace? How can there be when we have so many different storylines going on? Is there going to be just some earth-shattering earthquake all of Russia?
Ensemble scene from a Wes Anderson movie that happens in a railway station or something where everything, like people are just running around in circles and getting snatches of conversations that all fit together like a puzzle.
The frame holds still and every character runs back and forth in front of it at the same time.
I wouldn't hold your breath because one of Tolstoy's propositions is that there are no beginnings and endings to historical moments.
So don't hold my breath on a climax at all. How interesting.
Is he just going to string me along until he finally decides
to quit writing? Have you guys noticed that if you were to tell someone the story as we've read it thus far, there actually are some climactic moments, but they're always very understated.
Mm-hmm. Helene's death, for example. That is a climactic moment in Pierre's journey so far. And he told it to us in a way that does not have to do with Pierre at all.
Even the reconciliation between Andre and Natasha is very muted. It's funny that in this section, we get Vasily and his inability to emphasize the proper moments. I wonder if that to some extent, that's just what happens when you are narrating a tale that we're incapable of seeing the most important moments, or if that's part of what Tolstoy is trying to tell us, that as we experience this novel as though we're living it, the most significant important moments are kind of passing us by, and it's only after that we look back and go, oh, that was important.
Yeah. Oh, that was a big deal, as it turns out.
Yeah, which is more how we experience it in life, I think. You look back and say, that was a really significant moment for me. But usually in the moment, you're not thinking of that. He's telling the truth about some things.
Well, I'm really interested to see where it goes.
Me too.
I hope he doesn't just trail off into nothingness. I want some characters to have some resolution. Yeah. After a work this mighty, I would hope that there's some conclusion to be had. Well, my friends, go out into your weeks, find the next 5 chapters at some point, and we will see you next time around on How to Eat an Elephant. In the meantime, bon appetit.
Bon appetit.
Want to follow along with our reading? You can find a link to the schedule in the show notes for this episode. How to Eat an Elephant is a part of the Center for Lit podcast network. Visit our website at www.centerforlit.com to find our other literary shows, resources, and our membership program, the Pelican Society, where you can get access to a variety of live discussion groups. You can also find us on most social media channels. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time, happy reading!